Well, that shows what a pleasure it is to have Paul with us again for what has sort of become the annual Krugman lecture delivered by Krugman. This is very nice for us. As you know, Paul is one of the world's great economists. He made great contributions in his extreme youth to trade theory, the new trade theory, which explains and interprets inter-industry trade. That is why he was given the John Bates Clark prize for the best economist under 40, but he's now over 40, and he has therefore been felt free to broaden his canvas to include more or less everything which is wrong with the world. As you know, he writes a celebrated column in the New York Times in which he is doing a great deal, I think, to draw attention to some of the things which are not right in the world. He is currently visiting the Center for Economic Performance, which he does every summer. Very nice for us, and even better this year because he's not going on his bicycling holiday because he has to finish his blockbuster on economics. But he can do the advertising and I won't stop him. Paul, come and tell us about the world.
All right, so we have fancier technology here, but I'm still going to use paper, but with a bit of stuff. So the I gave a dummy title for the talk, which actually turns out to be right, which is Wither America. And those of you who heard me last year, I talked a lot about increasing inequality and the political economy thereof, and I'm going to talk about that as well. Since the title is Wither America, I should tell you all, I'm going to follow the Basil Fawlty principle from the famous don't mention the war. We can't totally avoid, and I will actually talk. Given one hypothesis about what's happening, it may matter quite a lot, and not just for the short run, but the politics of it. But I am going to be talking about political economy with and not. I probably won't be able to stop myself at some point, but the which since it does dominate all our thoughts, but I will try to stay off it. All right, let me be economistic for a little bit and talk about I'm not going to talk about what's happening to employment or GDP, but I think it's my starting point would be to take a look at the budget and budget policy, and just give you some fairly remarkable numbers about where we are right now. This is the United States according to what the Congressional Budget Office now projects. And it's they're projecting a budget deficit, 4.2% of GDP. There are worse budget deficits out there. It's not in itself completely extraordinary. One thing to say about, though, is that it has very little to do, according to their estimates, with the business cycle. The economy is still a long way from fully recovered, but it's not the main story. It is a structural budget deficit of around 3.5% of GDP, which is overwhelmingly attributable to the tax cuts that have taken place under the Bush administration. If you take all of them, if you do this stuff, you talk about EGTRA and JEGTRA, because all of these bills have got something. I think there's something deeply indicative about what's going on in the U.S., actually, the kitsch with which legislation is named. So we have the Job Growth and Tax Reform Act of, I'm not going to talk about the war, but the USA Patriot Act is actually the name of the thing. And so EGTRA is the Economic Growth Tax Reform and Recovery Act, and JEGTRA is the Job Growth Tax Reform and Recovery. They all have these wonderful, very kitschy names. But anyway, if you take the three tax cuts, the big ones in 2001, 2003, plus the smaller one in between together, it's big. It's 2.6% of GDP. It dwarfs even the effects of military spending and Homeland Security and all of that as a source of the deficit. So we have this large structural deficit, which would still be there without the tax cuts, but is much larger than the tax cuts. Much larger because of the tax cuts, and it's bigger than it seems to be because demographics. We have an aging population. We have there are other reasons for long-run budget woes, but we do know that the baby boomers are going to hit the retirement systems in less than 10 years now, and so there's a big overhang. And a crude way, you can do much more sophisticated ways of estimating what that really implies, and I've actually got Larry Kotlikoff's new book to try to review right now, but it's there. But the crude way is just to take the Social Security system, which is the biggest retirement program, has a current surplus which was supposed to be used to secure its future. It's not actually big enough, not quite, but it's about 1.5% of GDP. So really that should be not counted as, that should be counted as an addition to the deficit. Or put it this way, if we looked at the on-budget deficit, which doesn't include Social Security, it's another 0.5% of GDP. So we're already up to a fundamental or true or properly accounted deficit of at least 5%, 4.9, 5% of GDP for the federal government, which again is a pretty big number. Just the last thing to say, the last two things to say. If the tax cuts were temporary, designed for economic stimulus, this wouldn't be all that much to make a big deal about, but of course they're not. They're intended and propagandized for as a permanent set of tax cuts that we must never ever roll back. In fact, we should have more of them. So these are part of what's intended to be a structural reduction in revenue for the U.S. economy, which means, if you take all of this seriously, that this deficit isn't going away. The anything that we should be getting from economic recovery is already in there, and the fact that the structural is a bit smaller than the actual. If you take into account the overhang of the eventual cost of retirement programs, it's really substantial. It's more than 5% of GDP. And for scaling, you just want that, which is what is federal spending in the United States? It's around 20% of GDP. I'm not going to give you the breakdown in detail, but just to say 3% basic sort of running of the government, just the mechanics of doing it, the court system and so on, pretty much incompressible. 4% military spending, presumably incompressible. 2% interest on the debt, incompressible. So what's left, really, is not much more than half of that, around 11% of GDP, which is almost all social insurance programs. And if you say, well, everybody's against government spending and we should cut government spending, but you ask, well, what do we mean here? The answer is actually we're talking about a close to 50% cut in the social insurance programs would be what would needed to balance this budget. And social insurance programs means a little bit of it, one piece of it really. Medicaid is means tested, but for the most part, it's middle class social insurance programs. So that's the picture. Say, well, what makes them think, everybody says we're not going to cut those programs. What makes them think that this is going to work out? What's the economic theory or the budgetary theory under which all of this is possible? And you say, well, is there the administration always has projections which show the budget deficit falling in half over the next 5 years, and each year they issue such a projection, and each year the deficit is bigger than the year before, and they revise. Those are not to be taken seriously. The truth is the current projection, which says that the budget deficit is going to fall, is based in part on expiring tax provisions, which the administration is lobbying hard to have made permanent. So what they're actually saying is the budget deficit will shrink substantially according to our plan, which depends upon Congress not doing what we ask them to. A little bit peculiar. Anyway. So is there a theory about supply-side economics, about growth, that will solve the problem? Well, maybe somebody believes it, but there's every reason to believe that, I have no idea what George Bush thinks about the budget, but there's every reason to believe that the ideological architects do not believe that this is sustainable, that they, in fact, aim to use budget deficits as a way to force fundamental cuts in government programs. And it turns out that this is the second time we've been down this route, we had the rise of supply-side economics in the 1980s, and a few years later, some of the key figures got a little garrulous and actually talked about what they actually thought they were doing at the time. So Irving Kristol, very important neoconservative not in the foreign policy sense, though I guess that too now, but the neoconservative intellectual whose publication, The Public Interest, did a lot to create supply-side economics as a political force. Later on, waxing nostalgic about the days, talked about why he supported this, and he says, well, the task, as I saw it, was to create a new majority, because he wanted to, you know, reverse America's liberal drift, which evidently would need a conservative majority, which came to mean, in turn, a Republican majority. So political effectiveness was the priority, not the accounting deficiencies of government. And then, just in case you weren't quite sure what he means by that, he says talked approvingly of how he and his friends had a rather cavalier attitude toward the budget deficit and other monetary or fiscal problems. In other words, the tax cuts were not intended; they did not actually care whether the arithmetic added up. This was just a political platform, which I think one has to say is the same this time around. And the David Stockman, who was Reagan's budget director for a while till he was a little too frank with a reporter, actually talked about the what has become the common phrase now, starving the beast. We have all of these nasty social insurance programs, the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson. They're actually very stingy compared with European norms, even post-Thatcherite British norms. But nonetheless, conservatives really hate them, but they're also very popular. So how do you take them on? And the answer is, well, you deprive the government of the revenue. And then you can say, well, look, what can we do? We have to cut the spending. It just isn't, the revenue just isn't there. And that has clearly been the political strategy, the long game of the ideologues behind the administration, all of which is fairly familiar stuff in the U.S. now, although if you said it 2 years ago, you were accused of being a nutty conspiracy theorist, and now everyone says, well, of course, that's how it goes. One, I think, very important point is that the political theory behind starving the beast is actually completely untested. It's just a belief that they can actually do this, that they can turn around and say to people, well, you know, we have these budget deficits and we need to cut spending and we can't raise taxes, which would be a terrible thing, so we can cut these extremely popular programs. And the actual track record is that neither Reagan nor Bush so far has in fact done significant cuts in these programs. So there's an alternative possibility, which is that we are a banana republic, that we have these programs which we can't cut and taxes which we can't raise, and we have these enormous deficits which continue until the financial markets just say, wait a second, and all hell breaks loose. There's firm belief that this is going to work, as I say, with no real basis in experience. And for what it's worth, the one thing, the one major domestic policy initiative other than tax cuts to come out of the Bush administration is a major expansion in Medicare, one of the key entitlement programs. Happens to be an expansion calculated to deliver minimum benefit at maximum cost, but nonetheless it is an expansion in the program, so it is a funny thing. So, am I accusing our administration of launching into something, you know, really very, very bold policy without carefully considering things that might go wrong? Gosh, they would never do such a thing. Anyway, all right. Now, here's the point, though, which gets me into the political economy. Suppose it works. Leave aside the crisis risk or the possibility that you never do get the contraction. What you are really talking about here is a program of cutting taxes and then cutting spending on entitlements programs, really. Not, you know, for all the, whatever we may say about wasteful government spending, the programs that would have to be cut are transfer programs to the general public, primarily to the middle class. There is some means testing involved, but broadly speaking, these are programs that go to ordinary families. Just the public at large counts on these programs. Why would people support that kind of move? Why would people support that plan of action to cut taxes and then cut these social programs? Well, you might say that, well, look, what people... I've never understood what this is all about, but they gain on the swings, but they lose on the roundabouts, or something like that. That, all right, the typical family will find that its taxes are cut at the same time that its benefits are cut, and maybe it's all a wash, and then we have the efficiency effects of lower taxes, and it's people are convinced that that's all a good thing. Well, there's actually no particular evidence that tax cuts in this range have any notable favorable effect on the economy. You just can't find evidence that it's a... That you get an acceleration in potential growth, an acceleration, you know, other than possible temporary business cycle recoveries. And the question you would ask is, Is it reasonable for ordinary families, for the majority of voters, to believe that they are at least going to be roughly compensated for the loss of social programs by tax cuts? And that's where it becomes important, trying to understand what's going on, to look at whose taxes actually get cut. And we actually now do have better numbers than before. So I'll play a game here. This is the latest estimates of the three Bush tax cuts combined. It's actually as fully implemented. So there are pieces of it that aren't yet in place. Most notably, the estate tax phases out over the rest of this decade. So it's not, and it's of course very tilted towards the top. So it does add the tilting. Some of you may know that one of the quirks of the law, the salesmanship that's been used, is the estate tax, as now written, gradually phases out and is completely gone by 2010, and then springs back to 2000 schedules in 2011. So if you have a large fortune and you happen to die in 2010, it goes untaxed. And if you make it into January of 2011, most of it is taxed at a 55% rate, which would lead to some interesting incentives in December of 2010. But anyway, no one thinks that's going to happen. All right, point to make here. The tax cuts, there are lots of ways to say this, but I think this is the clearest version. The tax cuts are very heavily tilted towards people high up the income distribution. If you look at the bottom quintile, okay, nothing. This is the percent change in after-tax income. Basically, how will the after-tax distribution of income change compared to the pre-tax? Modest tax cuts for people near the, nothing near at the bottom, modest near the middle. As you go up towards the top, they get much, much bigger. And the top 1%, which in the U.S. starts at about $300,000 a year, family income gets a 6% increase, way above the average. And the top, people with more than $1 million income, which is about 0.13% of the population, gets a 7% increase in after-tax income. If I'd done it a different way and asked about distribution of the tax cut, what you actually find is that this class gets more. The tax cuts for the 0.13% of the population with incomes of more than $1 million are larger in total, substantially larger, than the tax cuts for the first three quintiles. So that little elite gets a bigger tax cut than 60% of the population. Now, the thing is, you could say, if we had a budget surplus and you wanted to cut taxes to sort of return the surplus to the public, there might be some case for tax cuts that are at least reflect income, maybe if we're worried about incentive effects, even tax cuts that went somewhat disproportionately to the top. But the point from earlier is that we are actually cutting taxes into a deficit. We would actually have a budget deficit, a sustained long-run budget shortfall, even without the tax cuts. And by having tax cuts, we accentuate that, which means that the tax cuts, you have a gain for the middle quintile. People in the middle of the income distribution have 2.3% higher after-tax income because of the cuts. But that's a little bit like somebody giving you a lavish Christmas gift purchased on your credit card, right? Where does that money come from? It has to come from a cut in programs that in turn benefit middle-income families. So now we don't know how the cuts will play out, if they'll play out, how it all works. But if you assume that the Star of the Beast thing works and there really are cuts in these big, nasty things like Social Security and Medicare, it has to be, given this distribution of income, that something like, I've tried different ways, there's no way that you can avoid having at least 70% of the population losing from this policy shift. Probably 80%. So it's what we're looking at, it appears, is a policy that is, it's a redistributionist policy, compared to the starting point, and it's a redistributionist policy from the bottom 80% of the population to the top 20%, and particularly, it's definitely extraordinary redistribution from the bottom 60% to the top 0.13%. It's kind of an amazing thing. Not what you'd expect to happen with majority voting, right? What's going on? What makes it even more puzzling is if you look at the context of what's been happening in the United States. So here are percentage changes in income from 1979 to 2001 by different by distribution within the United States. Again, bottom quintile, next quintile, third quintile, fourth, fifth, top 10%, top 5, and last is top 1. This is the Congressional Budget Office estimates. They don't go narrower than that, but we know from other data that if I had the top 0.1, roughly that million-plus class, we'd be looking at something like a 500% increase in the extremely narrow case. And last time I talked here, I talked about reasons why this might be happening. I'm not actually going to try and get into that this time, but we certainly have had a radical increase in inequality. And if your political model were anything like median voter theory, you would expect the policy response to this to be redistribution the other way. You'd expect that the public would be moving towards more progressive taxation, soak the rich, increase benefits for the middle class, because in some sense the people near the middle of the income distribution have less at stake in the overall level of taxes because they have a declining share of the income and ought to favor something that soaks the people who are claiming a radically increased share of income at the top and are therefore, you know, are there to be soaked. In fact, if you read some conservative commentators, they seem to have a constant fear that we're any day now we're about to have a shift towards soak the rich economic policies. They're constantly afraid. They look at the fact that the share of taxes paid by the top 1% or the top 5% of the income distribution has been rising over time. And they say, doesn't that encourage irresponsible sort of leftist populist politics among the public? The funny thing is that the increase in the share of taxes paid by people at the top is entirely the result of a soaring share of income at the top. In fact, up until 2001, the tax system became less progressive. They were back and forth, but overall, basically, we were soaking the rich less than before. And now, of course, these last 3 years, we have a radical move again towards taxes being cut at the top, compared with minimal cuts at the bottom. So that's the political puzzle: is how can this be happening now, right? I mean, how can that be? We have a democracy at least for a little while, and we have majority rule, and it would appear that we're having policies which are heavily tilted against the heavy majority of the public. So how can that be happening? Now, it is not just Bush. One of my favorite discoveries of the last few years has been the work of Keith Poole and Howard Rosenthal and Nolan McCarty, who do they're political scientists who do quantitative measures of political positions. And they use votes on bills to quantify where people stand on a left-right spectrum. They actually try for multi-dimensions, and it turns out that more and more U.S. politics just is a left-right spectrum. And you can use positions on various issues. Just to say vaguely, if you make the hypothesis that issues are lined up from left to right and the people are lined up from left to right, you can go searching for an ordering of issues and people that lets you extract where people are, and also lets you compare these things over time. So you can get positions, you can ask about the drift. And here, I just stole this directly from figure and all from someone else, but this shows you where we've been going, and it is a little too small to read, but I can tell you what it is. These are ranking presidents using their position on a number of issues that you can use to scale them. From liberal is down, conservative is up. I don't think there was a value judgment implied in that. And this is, so we go back and forth. We have Republican versus Democratic presidents. We have Eisenhower and Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush 1, Clinton, Bush 2, all ranked. And what you can see is, yes, Democrats are more liberal than Republicans, quite a lot. There are big swings in policy. But if you look at the overall trend, you discover that both parties are moving to the right, that the actual drift of policies has been, and this is essentially economic scaling, the actual drift of policies has been towards less progressive taxation, less redistribution, more favorable policies to the economic elite, even at a time when the economic elite is becoming ever more distant, ever richer compared with the typical resident of the country. It's a bit of a puzzle. I actually wonder, this is what the scale uses these issues, if you actually look at the content of the policies, I guess there are different ways that you might look at it, but if you look at things like rates of corporate taxation or top marginal tax rates, Eisenhower looks like a raving socialist compared with modern politics. We had a very, very much higher taxation both of profits and of people with high incomes in the 50s than we do today. So it's actually, and Clinton looks like by Eisenhower era standards, Clinton policies look extremely conservative economically. So it's a remarkable drift, and again, it's going opposite of the way you would think if you had a simple median voter, the typical person's interests are represented. So how can this be happening? That's the big question. How can it be that are we even the second largest democracy now? I guess so. The world's second largest democracy, the world's richest democracy anyway, biggest GDP democracy, appears to have its policy drifting in a direction, or in the case of Bush, galloping in a direction that is contrary to what you would have expected people to vote for, to support. And there are, I think, broadly speaking, two not mutually exclusive ways to think about it. One of them is that there actually has been a fundamental shift in the nature of politics. That the economic elite is just more powerful, and the concerns of ordinary middle or working class people are less well represented in the political process than they used to be. And there is there's quite a lot of evidence for that. The other is that it's always been true that the economic elite actually dictated policy, but that the economic elite is for whatever reason less concerned with the general state of the population than it used to be. I'm actually trying to educate myself more about this, so a lot of what I'm going to say is tentative. Let me just say that as my economistic bias, I like two because it's more fun to work on. It's easier to just do as an economist. But I suspect that there really is a lot of one going on, and the two can, of course, interact. So let me just take a moment. I'm sorry, I really am going to be more of an economist here for a second and just tell you, I give you a simple example of how two could work. The idea is not original, though. I've been talking to Roland Benabou, who's down the hall from me at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, and a lot of this is based on work he's done, but of course, if I've screwed up his ideas, it's my fault. Actually, a couple of my colleagues once had a paper with the acknowledgement said the authors would like to thank each other for helpful discussions and blame each other for remaining errors, but I can't quite do that. All right, let me give you this is a Benabou-inspired but Krugman-implemented and ruined thing. Think about a three-person society. So bear with me for a moment here. In which two people have got incomes of 30, and one person's got income of 60. And this is Roland's big idea. He said to make this story work, the kind of story, you actually have to think that government does good. Strange idea in modern America, but the government is a force for good. And in particular, he's got this idea that the government can do something which is really quite productive. The benefits are a lot bigger than the costs in taxpayer money. And so in this case, and think of it as building a public good, although, as I said, the real crux is actually social insurance. But still, think of it as building we're doing this textbook. Advertisement for the textbook, my wife and I are writing this textbook, and for public goods, we actually, the motivating example is the great stink of 1857 in London and the building of the sewer network that that move the state downstream. So we're talking about building the sewer network. Anyway, the which, let's say, costs $4 per person and benefits everybody $7. So it's a socially productive project. But let's just say that the way you're going to have to do it is with a tax that's proportional to income. So, and let's just imagine that for whatever reason, and we'll come back to the reasons in a bit, it's actually the wealthy third that controls the agenda. Well, if you had to pay for this project with a 10% with a tax, if you look, the total income is 120. So you'd have to have a tax. The cost of it would be 12, $4 per person. So you'd have to have a tax rate of 10%, which means that the wealthy person there would pay 6, but gain 7 from the project, and so he'd all be in favor of it. So it would go through. But now let inequality increase. And in this case, inequality increases in a way that's nobody loses. Just the wealthy person gets richer. His wealth goes to 120. And the same project is on offer. And now the wealthy person says, well, okay, total income here is 180. If we're going to pay for this project, we have to take 1/15th of total income, which means that I'm going to pay 8 for it. And the project still produces gains of 7 for each person, and now the wealthy third is against the project, which is it makes society as a whole poorer. There's something good that we could do, but the wealthy individual is alienated from the needs of society because he's so much wealthier than the society as a whole. So this is a little bit of, numerical example, economistic thing, but if you just put it more in greater generalities, you would say that the wealthy, if the economic elite, wherever it is you choose to start that, becomes increasingly distant in the way it lives in its economic concerns and increasingly dominant in the tax base because it's so wealthy, they will have diminishing incentive to support programs that are sort of for the broader social good. And I can then get blurry and actually mix my stories a little bit and say, look, if you get a situation in which wealthy people send their children to private schools and live in gated communities, they're probably not going to have very much interest in adequate funding for public schooling and for public safety. And we're just going to be in a situation where you would expect those people to become increasingly unsupportive of the institutions of a generous government. There's a little bit, I think this supports it. There's these political scientists who work on this have found their first big result was, actually I showed you that the rightward drift, but the really big result that they've found is the political polarization, both within the legislature and among individuals. What you discover is that the U.S. is pulling apart politically. The center does not hold. I think at this point there are no crossovers, for example, in the House of Representatives. There, as measured by this, there are now no Democrats to the right of any Republican, no Republicans to the left of any Democrat. That there used to be a substantial overlap. It's gone. If you just look, it's all pulled apart. And it turns out individuals as well, somewhat surprisingly. It's more extreme in Washington than it is in the real world. But there is a political polarization that's gone on. So that's which explains a lot about U.S. politics right now, right? You say, well, why don't the centrists step in and stop whatever the outrage of this morning's or this afternoon's outrage is? And the answer is there are no centrists anymore in the U.S. It's all gone. But the thing that the most recent research finds is they were asking, they noticed that political polarization has been increasing rapidly at the same time that income inequality has been increasing rapidly. And they thought, well, maybe what's happening is that at any given income, you tend to be either to the right or to the left, and because people are pulling apart in income, that's also pulling them apart in political views. It turns out that's a relatively minor factor. What's actually happening is that within economic groups, people are becoming increasingly, the association of your political views with your income has increased. And if I were to, Nolan McCarty would get mad at me, but if I were to summarize it quickly, I would say that the result is that rich people really have become much more right-wing than they used to be at any given level of richness, which is roughly consistent with this kind of story, just loss of interest. Okay, now, do I think that that's the whole story or even most of it? And the answer is no. There's probably there's certainly other stuff going on and very important things going on, which is that there appears to have been a shift. And I'm sorry if this all sounds, I guess I should say, I am not a Marxist. I certainly don't believe in classes as units of action, right? But I do believe that economic interests matter, and that you just cannot discuss U.S. economic and social policy without bearing in mind that the policies have very differential impacts on people at different levels of income, and that what seems to be happening is that the policies increasingly reflect the interests of people with very high incomes and not people with middle to lower incomes. So has there been the alternative is that there's just been a shift of power to the top. Now, why doesn't the median household rule? Right? Isn't that what we're supposed to believe about the way that that democracies work? That one person, one vote, and parties compete for majorities, and so the median person should rule. Well, okay. First thing to say is, particularly in the United States, voter participation is not very high, and it is income related. So the median voter is at something like the 60th to 70th percentile of income. So right there, you already have a question of, you have some reason why policies don't reflect the interest of the median household. That in itself is, that's not enough. If you go back to what I was saying, the policies appear to be tilted away from a good deal more, at least 75 to 80% of the population, and the big beneficiaries are way up there at the very top. So that's not actually. I think I probably said this last year, but if you ask when will this stop in the U.S., I think one vision I have is that it stops when the upper middle class realizes that these policies are biased even against them. That when people realize that it's really the very, very top that benefits. And I have this vision of the March of the Million Assistant Vice Presidents on Washington. probably motivated by the alternative minimum tax, but you don't want to know that. Anyway. It appears that... So it's not just voter participation. Now, there's the role of money in political campaigns. And that's obviously produces a bias towards the top. There's... what do I know about this? Nothing. Certainly not an expert, but you can't talk about U.S. politics, obviously, without talking about cultural divisions and both the religion and the race issue. And if you read Kevin Phillips's new book about the Bush dynasty, actually Phillips is the person who saw the Republican majority or the Republican victories coming back in the 1960s and is basically an old line Republican who's now horrified at where things are going and has become a big on the question of favoring the elite against the ordinary citizen. But he emphasizes a lot the role of evangelical Christianity in the whole political scene. And if you want, just now stepping completely away from my economics roots, just a question of what is the ruling coalition in the United States today? It is a coalition. It's not just the capitalists against the workers. It is the economic elite and the religious right, or the religious and cultural right. That more and more that just means religious. And so it's the alliance of the plutocrats and the preachers really that's running the country, and that's something that's relatively new. There's always been that religious element. There's always been the cultural element, but it didn't break in favor of conservative economic policies to the same degree 30 years ago. Race. We're still. If the Confederacy had managed to secede, U.S. politics today would look rather European. Just count up the votes, and you'd see how different the political scene is. And of course, it matters within northern states as well. So it's just a very big thing. Decline of alternate power centers. I think some people have done work on this. There needs to be a lot more. But if you ask what was the basis of these relatively pro-welfare state or pro-social insurance policies, pro-progressive taxation policies, during the long period after World War II. While there were powerful counterweights to the monetary influence of wealthy donors, so that, and in particular, above all, unions were, still are, even though they're much diminished, the unions are still terribly important for get out the vote efforts, and of course for, to some degree, still for campaign finance. So let me just show you, this is various numbers you can look at, but this is the U.S., yes, the unionized share of private. Now, by doing it this way, I use private. If government workers remain mostly unionized, they actually have not expanded as a share of employment over this period, but it's softer if you look at that. But basically, what we've seen over the past 30 years is the collapse of the private union movement in the United States. Why that happened, we could talk about. It's probably partly political. I'm sure there are people in this room who know more than I am, so I should probably shut up. But just to say that, that clearly that's very important. It means that, that an important base for redistributionist policies, for social insurance policies, is greatly eroded. So that's got to be an important part of the story. Question here. The rise of, just before I came over here, I just discovered that there was a, there's a new study. I found this about 20 minutes ago. It just turns out to be perfect. It was looking at experts on public radio in the United States. So we have, you know, public radio, by repute, is highly liberal. It's not actually in reality anymore. But in any case, they get experts to come on and talk about the issues of the day. And where do you go for experts? Well, you go to think tanks. And so someone went through and looked at all the experts and just asked, you know, what kind of think tanks do they come from? And the answer is 4-1 from conservative think tanks. And that's not surprising because there are more and much more lavishly funded conservative think tanks. And it was not always thus. There wasn't really a conservative intelligentsia in the United States, and not a well-supported one in 1970. And there was a deliberate creation of the network of think tanks, of publications, and so on, that now very largely dominates public discourse, provides the facts, or maybe I say facts in quote marks, that often dominate news reporting. And if you ask, you know, how did that happen, the answer is a few intellectuals convinced a few billionaires to put up the money. If you look, there's a vast array of right-wing think tanks, organizations, publications in the United States. Nearly always, it sounds like it's a very diverse group, but if you look at the funding, it all comes back to 8 major foundations. So the Scaife family, the Coors family, the Koch family, the Bradley Foundation. So it really by, this was a case of organization, and a few people, including Irving Kristol, who I quoted back in it, at the beginning, helping to organize this network, which in turn, you know, shapes the debate. And one of the things always important to realize in trying to understand political economy is that, you know, most people don't have time to study the issues. They pick up impressions about where things are. And so propaganda, if it's done skillfully, works. And so we have the famous one is the estate tax. If you ask people, you know, how many people actually end up paying estate tax in the United States? Of course, the correct answer is less than 2%. But most of the public thinks that a majority of people end up paying some estate tax. And you know, death happens rarely enough that you don't usually pay attention to it. So the view heavily propagandized works. Ad campaigns. There was an ad campaign against Tom Daschle, the Senate Minority Leader, which castigated him for his support of maintaining the estate tax and showed a barber lamenting that he wouldn't be able to leave his business intact to his family. And of course, the estate tax doesn't kick in for a couple until it's at least $1.5 million in assets. So that was some barbershop. anyway, there. Last thing, of course, media ownership, concentration. I don't know. In much of the media, it's quite subtle. I mean, I'm sure that, at some level, you don't, as a Time Warner employee, being a real muckraking populist is not too well received. It's not in much of the media. It's not a case of the corporate ownership says, you know, we want you to follow a conservative economic line. But there's got to be an influence. And then, of course, there is a significant segment where, well, look, I mean, your fantasy might be that that if you're part of the Murdoch empire, that if you work for Fox News in the United States, that every morning you get a memo that tells you how to slant the news today. Well, you do, actually. It's called the memo, and it's and everybody gets it in the morning. So it works exactly as you might have thought. All right. Now the big question. So all this is happening. Of course, it was given tremendous... I think the 2001 tax cut in the United States, which was is a little bit more than half of the numbers I showed you, was pushed through because people didn't really understand what the numbers were. They thought there was a budget surplus. The 2003 tax cut, which is what bumps this up from 1.5 to 2.6% of GDP and makes this a much, much bigger story, was something that was pushed through immediately after the fall of Baghdad. So it was really a case of exploiting the political momentum of war to make it happen. So I'm breaking my Basil Fawlty rule now, but it is important. And in general, what we've seen is that in the United States, over the last 3 years, this trend towards an increasingly rightward tilted economic and social policy was given a huge acceleration by the political payoff to the Bush administration from its reputed stature as leading the war on terror. It was amazingly difficult to ask questions like, since when do you cut taxes in the face of a war? But it was clearly, it gave them a lot of political momentum. And now the question we have to ask is, well, these are both related. One question, very important question here is, when you follow these policies, basically, do Niebuhr, somebody said Robin Hood backwards, when you follow reverse Robin Hood policies, do they actually, in turn, create the political basis for more policies of the same kind? That is there a feedback? Does the reign of a right wing government create the political basis for continuing right wing government? And what's very clear is that the intellectuals and the lobbyists behind this very much do believe that. They believe that they can actually. It's not that, okay, we hold the White House this time around, we hold Congress this time around, so let's get our policies, and, you know, of course, there will be other guys in later on. They believe that they can use their dominance to lock in an environment that works to their benefit, which is, for what it's worth, it's very clear that there were positive feedbacks in the original rise of the welfare state, that if you go back in the United States to the New Deal, that the Roosevelt administration didn't just have policies, policies, but also pretty much deliberately fostered the growth of unions, which provided a power base, increased government employment, government employees became a power base. The original tax and spend, which everybody in the U.S. talks about tax and spend, but the original phrase comes from one of Roosevelt's political advisors who said, we're going to tax and spend, win and win. That by expanding the role of government and by expanding redistributionist programs, they're also creating the political base for their agenda to continue. Clearly, you could do this in the reverse direction, or at least you might think you can do it in the reverse direction. Particular examples now, the privatization. One of the things that is a constant theme here is outsource government services. You know, switch them from government employees to private firms. Well, that's, it's always done allegedly for efficiency, although it turns out that the evidence for cost savings is very, very weak, and in many cases pretty much negative. But one thing it does do is it gets rid of public sector workers who have an interest in maintaining strong government. It gets rid of unionized public workers, which is another one of the last bastions of union membership. And it also creates a class of donors who pay for the right to keep on getting the contracts. And we're not going to mention Halliburton. Anyway, but all of that. There is a lot of positive feedback that can happen here. And so there is a real possibility that this can all be locked in. And then, of course, the big question, which is, are we looking at just a swing of the pendulum back and forth, the cycles of American politics, or are we looking at, I say an absorbing state, are we looking at a place where we lock in a much diminished, much more pro-elite, much less social insurance type society for an extended, very extended period? I guess what I should have put up here is, what if that's true? And of course, we all have pretty there's you can be as conspiracy theory minded as you like in all of this, in terms of what's happening in the U.S. You can be as extreme as you like. The general rule of U.S. politics these last 3 years has been that last year's crazy conspiracy theory always ends up being today's conventional wisdom. But in any case, assuming all of this happens and it really is a radical swing, you don't see this happening in other advanced countries. You see bits of it, but nothing like the same extent. And so one question is the United States, which is already quite different from the rest of the advanced world, is it going to look like a completely different society? Is the United States going to go back to a 1920s style dog-eat-dog capitalism while the rest of the West is a post-World War II social insurance state? And how much will we really be able to talk to each other or deal with each other if we've diverged that much? Last point. If you believe these kinds of stories about positive feedback, swings of the pendulum that get locked in place, contingent events can cast a very long shadow. So that you could have argued that, put it this way, 6 months ago, you could very easily have argued that the terrorist attack on the United States was going to indirectly have the effect of locking in a very major shift to the right in U.S. politics. And I have to say, if you asked me this week, I would say that the debacle in you-know-where has a pretty good chance of unlocking the whole thing and actually causing the pendulum to swing the other way. But I guess we'll find out at least the first stage of that in about 6 months. Thanks.
What a marvelous, wide-ranging talk. Things to agree with and things probably to disagree with. You go first. Have we got a mic? Yes, there it is.
All right.
Coming your way.
Simon Nikolov, Department of Government. Thank you, Professor Krugman. Really interesting talk. I would like you to elaborate a little bit on the issue of Protestant ethics, because there's something I quite don't understand. Usually, people who are making a lot of money under that paradigm should be ashamed of themselves and redistribute a little more. The United States still has the highest number of foundations, which in some sense give a little bit back of money. How would you address this issue?
It is a little interesting. I mean, there are two things that are really quite different about the U.S. from some of the tradition are that you do find that the whole idea of charity and what can I say? There is an old tradition where religiosity goes with actually a strong social concern, but not apparently in the big politically effective religious groups in the United States now. Although there is another side to it, and some people are saying, you know, there is a Christian left in the U.S. too, so that is. But it's much less well organized and much less effective. The whole business about philanthropy,
maybe that comes in time. I mean, I'd say that the feel right now is more like the early Gilded Age in the U.S. You know, the big philanthropic era came later on, progressive era, and there doesn't seem to be very much of that right now. What's actually interesting is to see where you do see signs of it, how virulent the reaction is. So the biggest campaigner for retaining the estate tax is Bill Gates Sr., the father, and he's been trashed, and Gates himself has been trashed for vile motives in the Wall Street Journal. How dare he suggest that people like himself should continue to pay taxes? It's a very odd environment. The other thing to say is there's funny undercurrents, you know, funny sociological undercurrents, and one of them is really the whole issue of nepotism, which I thought in the U.S. context was, you know, it was poisonous to have even the appearance of. But now it's all over the place. It's quite open. Again, the current administration, it's always been, right? There's always been family ties, and God knows I work for a half-time for a publication that's owned by a dynasty. But now you see a lot of sons and daughters of. I think it's hard to find a top-level Bush administration official who doesn't also have at least one offspring with a medium-level job in the administration, and it's kind of remarkable. Just one last thing: it is really impossible not to talk about this. There's been some reporting in the last few days about the staff in the Green Zone in Baghdad, which turns out, who are these people? You know, who's actually there? And it turns out they're very young, very inexperienced. They all seem to have been hired because they posted their resumes at the Heritage Foundation. But one person who was interviewed a lot, talked a lot about the challenges, turns out to be the daughter of Michael Ledeen, who's a prominent neoconservative and one of the big people. So a lot of the people involved seem to be sons of, daughters of. I think it is, again, it's this ethos of wealth building that somehow has really transformed the country. It doesn't seem a lot like the country I grew up in.
Professor Paul Rukman, I'm pleased to be here. As an antidote to this administration's delusion about their own economic drive, you have prescribed or you have suggested that this administration needs rapid growth to make up.
Yeah.
And at the same time, in your own paper, I mean, IH Herald, I don't have New York Times or Washington Post, your colleague, Mr. Philip Bowring, suggested that the compliance may be good. So the government demands free flow of freedom of movement for capital and goods. But when it comes to the freedom of movement for migrant workers like me or professionals, I'm not talking about the individuals sneaking to the waiver, individuals sneaking through the Mexican border. I'm talking about physicians or economists like you. So your embassy, I mean, the part of your administration embassy is abusing us. Oh, you know how much we see. Why is this happening? Without individual, like, without the...
Okay.
Without the
I assume this is about... This is about the sort of security-related, the closing down of visas and all that.
Precisely, yep.
Yeah, it's not an economic policy. You know, I mean, it's crazy stuff, right? It's hitting sort of randomly, and it's not an economic policy. It's just it's security policy, and this whole business of leaving aside the war and all of that, just the response in terms of trying to clamp down on individuals has been this sort of sinister Keystone Cops routine, where on the one hand there lots of people are being arrested or deported for no particular basis. On the other hand, they seem to have no idea what they're doing, and it is disrupting. I mean, one of the things I gave a little seminar here yesterday. Some of the puzzles in our data appear to be possibly explained by a sharp drop in immigration in the last few years, which is not a result of policy, but a result of just intrusive, crazy, Homeland Security behavior. What? No.
Sorry. Your analysis, if you compare with your analysis Brazil and the U.S.,
why do you get
differences in outcome of voter behavior, and now the case of, say, Lula in Brazil and somebody like Bush in the U.S.?
Okay, that's actually... one answer is there may be a reversing point. That is, that there comes a... Or at least an equilibrium point. I mean, presumably this doesn't go on without limit until two families have all of the GDP. So there comes a point, you know, again, my march of the assistant vice presidents on Washington eventually puts this to a stop. The other thing is, my understanding, which is very, very limited about Brazil, is that although it has enormous income inequality, it also has very powerful public sector unions, which is sort of the core of Lula's support. But also, I mean, people, there are moods. Can always be a little too mechanistic about these things, which, you know, as an economist, I guess I tend to do. But there are also points when the public sort of says, we're sick of this. The progressive movement in the United States arose at a time when I don't think you can say there was anything about the income distribution that made people in 1910 more prone to reform than people in 1890, but they just, people have finally had enough of it all. And for what it's worth, I mean, U.S. electoral politics right now, the big surprise is that, we currently have a system where hard money can't be given by organizations, has to be given by individuals, and it's a $2,000 limit, which actually means that what you want is the sort of highly affluent but not billionaire types to all pony up their $2,000. And just 6 months ago, we were thinking that was a huge advantage for the Republicans, that there just were not enough people willing to give their $2,000 to a Democrat. In the last month, Kerry has raised twice as much as Bush. And I think that's just a lot of fed-up assistant vice presidents who really want these guys out.
The more I practice economics, the more I feel I should have studied more politics when I was here at the LSC. But one of the things questions you raised, in me at least, is what could be the countervailing forces for the shift of power to the power elite you talked about? The unions clearly no more. And I wonder whether universities could play a role in that and how effective they are at doing that. They may or may not be. And whether in the way universities are being increasingly funded these days, whether that role is going to become more difficult if they can play that role in the future.
Yeah. Boy, what we talk about in terms of countervailing powers is probably actually, you know, unions could stage at least a partial comeback. It's hard to see why necessarily they have to be so far down. But then other things, it's less clear. Universities, university professors are not known for cohesive action. as any administrator will tell you, I think herding cats is the usual phrase. There is an issue that the whole issue of funding is a big one. And it's not just how university research is funded, but I think also if you were to ask about academics and how academics make a living, you discover in the United States at least that in many fields the university salary is only a piece, and that's got to make it difficult as well. So yeah, I mean, if you want to talk yourself into a pessimism which says that this is unstoppable dominance by money politics, you can get there. But I guess I have hopes that there is some idealism that can turn it around. Yeah. There's. I think we're trying to get yes. Sorry, the business with the mics makes it.
Oh, yes. Sorry.
Makes it very difficult because I can't figure out usually who's talking.
I'm wondering if you might comment on the part of this whole picture that you drew for us at the beginning that's played in the U.S. by tax expenditures, particularly the deduction for mortgage interest and the charitable donation deduction, from both an economic perspective and a political perspective.
Oh, boy. Well, maybe I can be briefer on that because the answer is I haven't thought it through at all. I'm you know, the mortgage deduction is a really distorting thing, and if they try to take mine away, I'm going to get furious. So, yeah.
I'm wondering if you can comment on what you think about John Kerry's proposal for rescuing American jobs being outsourced overseas, and in terms of his ideas of, on trade policy and tax incentives?
Yeah. Okay. The job parts of the proposal, the pre-notification and so on, is very mild stuff. It's basically speed bumps to slow up the process if a company's about to outsource. It's unlikely to stop a company that really wants, really has decided that there's a huge advantage to operating in Bangalore. So it's nothing. I mean, I guess you could, under some very expansive definition, call it protectionist, but barely. I think it was the mildest proposal that he could come up with that would at least show that he was addressing the issue. The tax, I actually have not done the homework on the tax proposal, but again, it appears to me to be something that is defensible on grounds other than repatriation of jobs. It makes a fair bit of sense just as a tax proposal. So again, it's very mild. I'll give you my prejudice, which I can't justify with a lot of documentation. I can tell you that the people around Kerry are, very internationalist. Basically, if it is Kerry, it's going to be reconstituting a lot of the Clinton economic team. So it's very he'll have to do some things for the labor supporters. But if I were a European worrying about protectionist presidencies, I would actually be more concerned about a second Bush term. I guess even though they're trying to portray it as Kerry the protectionist. Just if you actually look at the details of the proposal, there isn't much that's protectionist in them, and if you look at the people, you have a pretty good assurance that these are multilateralist types who are not likely to go out and defy the WTO.
I'd be interested in knowing your opinion about what consequences the right-wing shift in American politics is going to have on European politics, because there seems to be a sort of ideological long wave that is affecting Europe at the moment, whereby there's a tendency towards rolling back the state, pretty much molded on the American model.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think you really have to look at the U.S. to understand how mild anything that happens in Europe is by comparison. I mean, my understanding is, if you actually look at the specifics, is that post-Thatcher Britain was still a much more generous welfare state than anything the U.S. ever had. Right, so that what you think of as a radical rightward shift looks to us still like creeping socialism, and it's and look, in a European context, if I were sitting here, particularly if I were sitting in Germany, I'd be reviled as a right wing laissez-faire, because there incentives do matter, and there is such a thing as overregulation and all of that, but it's nothing like the real attempt to gut the whole social insurance system that you see in the U.S. and Europe. It's just hard to contemplate. Yeah.
There is a puzzle, despite all your brilliant explanations. You're describing a situation in which 80% of the people lose.
Right.
In a highly educated country with a diverse, reasonably diverse media, lots of brilliant people like yourselves, and a very, very large party, which was recently in power,
yeah,
which has this 80% of the population to capture. It seems to me a simply staggering failure of political entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I'm. What do we know? I mean, it's there. Tremendous diffidence about making the issues, right? But God knows, you know, I have no brief for Democratic leadership on political leadership anyway. These past 20 years, and it is a question. And let's just say it is a mystery. You do wonder why it's been so easy for one side to wrap itself in the flag and also wrap itself in family values, and the other is so ineffectual. And it's a source of puzzlement. But the question, I guess, would be, does that mean this is wrong, that the public really understands that these policies are in there helping them? And the answer is, I don't think that's true. I think that you can be reasonably clear on the actual math that the public is by and large voting for policies that are against its interests. And by the way, for what it's worth, polling on questions, do you think that more tax cuts are a good thing, which has a higher priority, tax cuts or reducing the deficit, and so on down the line, all show the public actually appearing to have quite liberal views at this point, or at least not nearly as conservative as the government. And the latest polls also show quite a strong streak of populism, that people generally feel that corporations and the rich are not paying enough taxes. And it is a remarkable thing that you can't get political traction out of this. And it's true. I mean, it's not, I think if that were the issue on which the campaign was going to hinge, it would be an easy Bush win. Not because people necessarily agree with him, but because they can't get exercised about it. And the other things dominate. And as it happens, that doesn't appear to be what it's going to be about.
We all react with considerable indignation at the prospect that the top 0.13% of the population get the benefits of these swinging tax cuts.
Right.
But doesn't this component of the population arrange its tax affairs in such a way that probably doesn't pay that much by way of tax anyway? And so, you know, when you do deliver tax cuts there, it kind of, to some extent, reduces the incentive for them to use expensive tax consultants and lawyers to dodge taxes, i.e., share of the cake versus the overall size of the cake.
Actually, there's been quite a lot of work on that, and it is true that if you look at actual effective tax rates, I mean, of course, we don't know about totally concealed income, but I think, but if it looks as if actual effective tax rates, problem of not having of this high tech, no, I can probably just draw, right? Sorry, I'm going to make a note about a question here. If you look at income, not working. Well, it doesn't work if I don't turn that one on. There we go. High tech. Income versus tax rate. At the federal level, we have a mildly progressive system that then does that at the very top. That it is in fact true that people with very, very high incomes manage, I think it's, I should know the numbers offhand, but I don't, but the top 400 taxpayers end up paying about 5 percentage points less than the average of the top 1%. And that's largely, but we think that's largely because the U.S. tax system favors capital income over earned income, in particular the capital gains over earned income, and the very wealthy realize their income primarily through capital gains. And deeper analysis apparently says that here's where the fact that people are not move in and out of the top 400 matters quite a lot, that if you take people's five-year incomes, it's more like this, so there isn't actually a significant drop-off for the super rich, except for the people who are always super rich, which is Bill Gates and a few other people. I think the point is that it's not that easy in today's world to actually just completely have your income, a very, very high income, disappear off the radar screen. with a little effort at enforcement, you can actually do this, get the income as well. So I don't think it's actually a case where, well, those people don't pay taxes anyway. They do a lot of stuff, and tax evasion is, well, tax avoidance is rapidly on the rise, and tax evasion is rapidly on the rise, which is another story, by the way. You know, the Internal Revenue Service is radically underfunded and understaffed, and all indications are that modest increase in its resources would collect a lot, you know, would be a very high value and high return investment for the government, and that's by design. It's been deliberately starved. And that's a whole other story. And actually, David K. Johnson of New York Times has a very good book about all of that, which is perfectly legal. It's called, which is pretty impressive for, again, for the chicanery involved politically. But anyway, another story.
Yes, we have heard about the voodoo economics, and most recently, economics seems to be sort of ruled by a Disneyland scenario. I'm wondering when you say that there has been no action on the part of the professorial class. I'm wondering about the economics professors and where you feel you stand amidst them. Sometimes I see you as a lonely voice in the whole economics profession. But do you feel sort of isolated here?
No, actually. Economics professors have gotten a lot noisier lately. I mean, on both sides. But to my misfortune, I'm actually out there, you know, twice a week in front of a large number of people. But it's, but Alan Blinder at Princeton, a lot of people are talking much more these days. And what I think is hard for a lot of my colleagues. You want to believe that we're actually having a serious discussion, you know, that when we talk about these things, that we really are talking about actual trade-offs, and it's very hard for an academic to grapple with the notion that the budget projections by the government of the United States are blatantly, almost sneeringly dishonest. You know, so it is kind of hard to get into it, but I think it's happening more. Actually, if we come out the other end of this tunnel, I think actually we'll feel that there were a lot of people who did step up and try to make a difference.
Well, you've been, I think you've been too modest in your answers to these two questions about academia. I actually went to Princeton, I think on the day the war broke out. And when I got there, I was amazed to find that the vast majority of the people there were opposed to the war. Certainly, sitting here in England, you would never have known this. And I think it's really incumbent on academics to engage more in the public debate than many of us do. And the historic justification for universities was always that they were an independent source of social criticism. And I think that many of us have not performed that role as we should have done, and as Paul has. And I think he's a shining example to us. And that is certainly why he's made the impact he has, why all of you are here, and why you've responded as you have to having him here. Thank you very much, Paul.